He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hi, Jim.
Hey, you were supposed to meet me at the Shake Shack last night at 10 o'clock. I waited. Yeah. And you never showed up.
Okay, you didn't go either.
I had to eat yours, actually.
Yeah, you didn't go either.
I'm going tonight.
Yeah, okay.
I am going tonight,
actually.
Give me
a full report.
I'll bring you an extra one.
I want one of those custards, the vanilla custards. I've read about those.
I want it.
And I think they have some kind of exotic milkshakes
as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim.
One of everything, please.
Okay.
So how different would your thirsty Thursday have been if you could have taken the tea home at 2 a.m.? Joining us in the studio to talk about the MBTA and whether or not it will ever extend its service into the wee hours of the morning is the author of the front page Globe story and Globe transportation reporter, Martine Powers. Good morning. I always say good morning. Good afternoon, Martine.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Martine. So I was stunned by what you found in the story this morning in the Globe. Tell people.
Well, I'm actually surprised that you're stunned because it seems like everyone under the age of 35, their first priority when it comes to what they want from the city of Boston is tea service between 1 and 2:30 a.m. So the MBTA Rider Oversight Committee conducted the survey that they sent out over Facebook and Twitter asking people, you know, do you want this service, late night service? And also, how much would you pay for it? And how long would you wait between buses or trains to be able to get home? And people said, first of all, that it was basically an overwhelming amount of people said that they wanted this late night service, and also that they would be willing to pay double or in some cases triple.
That was the part.
The current fare to
stun me. They'd pay a lot of money for the late night service.
Yeah, exactly, and also that they'd be willing to wait quite a while. You know, they said it doesn't have to be every 5 minutes, every 6 minutes. It could be even a twice an hour train at like 1:30 and 2 and 2:30, but that they would use it.
We're one of the outliers, right, in terms of major cities in the country. What time is the tea shut down here? 1 o'clock? What time is the tea shut down?
So it officially shuts down at 1. I mean, a lot of stations, the last train comes through around 12:25, 12:30.
But that's aberrational, is it not? In most major American cities, it's open either later or around the clock, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people immediately think of New York City, where it's open 24/7. You can get around any time of day or night.
And we had you wrote about this, and I remember it at the time. We had an experiment, did we not, on some limited lines, late night service in the mid-aughts or whatever. What happened to that?
So about 10 years ago, they had a night owl bus service instead of the trains. And so they took the most popular bus routes, and then they also had buses running along kind of comparable to the current T routes. And so that was somewhat popular, but apparently not popular enough to make enough money that it
was
worth
their while. I can see where that didn't work then, though, because now they have these apps on your mobile phone, right, which tell you when the buses are coming or how often they're going to come. I mean, that's been one of the things I think drives people insane about the T. You never know. Is the train going to come in 10 minutes? Is it going to come in 2 minutes? Is it going to come in 20 minutes? If you're in a rush and you're debating whether you have to run out and get a cab. Now, bus is even more important. Who wants to stand out on the street in February at 1 o'clock in the morning if you don't know when the bus is coming? Now, can't they tell you the bus is going to be here in 2 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what a lot of people are hoping for, that this service would be a lot more popular because of this kind of real-time data apps that are possible, as well as the countdown clocks. I mean, who knows if it would be possible to put countdown clocks at bus stops, but those, you know, really help people understand how long they'll need to wait to get home.
That's the voice of Martine Power. She wrote the piece about expanding tea hours, this overwhelming response from riders. If you want to give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Are you amongst those who would not only vote for longer and later hours, but willing to pay for them? You know, when I first read your story, I assume it was going to be the typical thing where, does everybody want more service? Yeah, of course we do. But they don't want to pay for it. But here, as Marjorie said, there's a clear, people are willing to pay essentially whatever it takes. And it's not just about convenience. It's about safety, too. When you're in a bar, and it's at 1, we were talking about this before we went on the air, and it's 1 o'clock at night, and you've had a couple of pops, as they say, in this neck of the woods.
Couple of cocktails.
I mean, your choices are fairly limited, are they not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people going out say, you know, I could pay $35 for a cab to go home.
Right.
Or I could just drive there and hope that, you know, I get home okay by driving, and that's not really safe.
And you know what other thing, two things drive me nuts. Okay, first of all, everybody says, oh, we can't do this in Boston because the T is too old and it takes too much time to maintain it. But you point out in your piece, Philadelphia's got an ancient T system, too, and they still manage to have these late night hours. Plus, you know, I don't get out much. I almost never go anywhere, but I actually went to Rome last week because I was visiting one of my kids over there. you go to other countries and you get on the subway and you're like stunned at how fast they are, how clean they are, how reliable. We look like podunk central here. You know, I mean, the New York subways at least are faster, but they're really dirty and filthy and disgusting and hard to figure out. And Boston, I mean, are they ever going to stop the squeak? You know, when you come to Boylston Street on the Green Line, you come into Boylston Street and the squeak, you almost need fingers in your ear. Why can't, absolutely. I mean, it's like, we're like in the 18th century.
Well, I think that's a lot of the things that you're listing are a lot of parts of the governor's transportation plan that they're trying to push through. I mean, I think the T's argument is if we had more money, we could do things like fix up the Green Line. We could, you know, have late night service. We could have all these other things that people complain about all the time. But because they're so cash strapped, they say that fixing those things are impossible right now.
Speaking of cash strapped, I had Beverly Scott on last night, who's the on television. She's a relatively new general manager of the T, and I have to say, quite an engaging personality. And we talked about the whole fare crisis. Remember a couple days ago, you heard $140 million shortfall. Is the state going to fill it? Is the state not going to fill it? Listen to this exchange with Beverly Scott last night.
There will not be a fare increase in this calendar year. Is that correct?
My prediction is that everybody understands the work that needs to be done. And at this point in time, we need to give the space.
But no fare increase.
But no fare increase.
Fair enough.
So the fact that she said there'll be no fare increase this year, in part because the Speaker of the House has said he's going to fill the hole, maybe not as quickly as the T needs, but in relatively short order. Does that make it more likely or less likely that, I guess, what some would consider to be a non-necessity expansion of hours in the middle of the night, does that make it more likely or less likely, Martine?
I think in some ways that makes it more likely just because what Beverly Scott is talking about is this package that she's hoping comes from the State House. And part of that package may include this suggested $25 million that the governor wants for like moderate T service improvements. And so if that $25 million is part of this package that's given to the T that helps reduce or helps prevent fare increases, then late night service might be brought along with that.
So it actually is in some fashion. I wasn't aware of this. It's actually is some part of his $1 billion for transportation
package. It's a small little line, but it's in there.
877-301-8970. Is there anybody who doesn't want more late night service? But the critical question is not do you want it, but are you willing to pay for it? 877-301-8970.
And think about this. How much would you, if you're somebody that's 20 years old and you're riding the T all the time and going out partying Friday and Saturday nights, how much does it mean to you? And if you are a parent of kids that are 20 years old going out partying, I mean, how much would you give them? I'd give them, you know, a nice little 10 spot to take the T home at night instead of having to worry about them. You know,
I would say there are a lot of 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s that would like to be able to take the T after a late movie or a play or something. I mean, one of the problems, I'm serious, Marty, if you go to a play in downtown Boston and you decide you want to go out and have a drink afterwards and you don't want to spend $40 for parking, how are you supposed to get home? Bicycle?
I don't think you would know because I think you're one of the people that's spending the $40 for parking as well. And the other thing is, it's a great point, the airports that people can't, you know, their late night flights. You had a great anecdote in your story about, or maybe it was a commenter, but I read it somewhere, where somebody actually spent the night in an ATM vestibule waiting for the train the next morning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that the other part of this is it's not just going out, you know, for drinks or coming back from the bar. It's a lot of people who work late shifts and are trying to get home or
excellent
trying to get to work.
Point.
And they the only way that they can do that is by taking a cab.
Martine, I've slept under ATMs many a night. Let me just tell you. Let's go to Travis. You're in Elliott, Maine with Martine Powers from the Boston Globe. Hey, Travis.
Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Excellent.
Fine,
thanks for the call.
Well, I was going to say I actually recently moved to the New England area from Philadelphia. So another Philly boy here. But I was going to say I work in a restaurant that gets out very late, and I relied on the L to be running after midnight, after 1 to 2 a.m. And they did shut down the trains, but they still had the bus lines open all night. So if you need to rely on that as an option for transportation, it was there, and I think that's a necessary public service if public transportation is important to the city.
L is short for elevated, for those of us who are not from Philadelphia. I mean, it's in Travis, thanks for the call. He said, I don't remember exact words, but Travis said, it's sort of like what you expect from your government.
You do sort of expect it.
Be there for us when we need you to get us from place to place. So how do politicians and others respond? I know they're tight finances, But I love Travis's approach. This is something we should be able to get from you as an expected service.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of politicians do hear that, and they do kind of see that as a legitimate concern, not just, you know, for drunk kids running, wanting to run around and be drunk a little bit later, but from people, you know, like Travis, who are trying to get home from work. But again, it's just that it's a lot of it is a money issue, and there's not a lot of money around here right now.
You know, the point that was made, this whole notion about working late, which I think you mentioned a second ago, what are people supposed to do? I mean, what is a person who
supposed
works
to jog home, Jim?
No, I'm serious.
2 in the morning.
What is if you were to corner Beverly Scott, right? Well, she's relatively new to town. Rich Davey, the Secretary of Transportation, who we both think is a very responsible guy who does take the tea. What would his answer be as to what that person on the overnight shift is supposed to do? They got out of work at 2 a.m. or 4 a.m. What are they supposed to do?
I mean, I think his answer would be that, you know, they're going to have to take a cab home or they're going to have to drive home, and that's really unfortunate, and that he wants to fix that problem too.
Of course, one of the reasons that the MBTA is broke is because until Deval Patrick changed the rules as governor, used to be able to retire from the T at like 41, I think, if you started
20 years is 20 now. 20, that's
yeah,
right.
So if you started at 20, you could retire at 40 with your full pension or
who
almost
did
your
that
full
at
pension
41,
and
Marjorie.
Your full health care. One of the best paid guys in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts,
head of the convention
Jim,
center,
Jim Rooney. I think he's pulling in. What is he pulling in? About 300 grand.
Whatever he's
I
doing.
I think he took a pay cut recently, though. In fairness to Jim Rooney, because we wrote about his exorbitant salary so many times in the paper. Bruce, who are we going to? We're going to Tom from Cambridge. Hi, Tom from Cambridge.
Hi. How are you guys?
Great.
Excellent. Well, that was
Tom
the end of that.
Cambridge, are
Tom, you still there or no? We'll
hey,
get back
to
that. Yeah, is that
yes.
you, Tom?
Yeah.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
I was calling because I worked at a bar around the Fenway area, and you know we were open till last call on a regular basis. So when I have to get home that night, you know, I have to drive a lot. However, the big problem with driving for me is that parking around there is $35 during the fox season.
Ah. So that's so you would be a candidate. How much would you pay a Tom to take the tea home at night?
I took the survey, you know, through Facebook.
You did?
I said I would pay up to $9 because my cab drive is 25. So, you know, it's actually a great discount for me, you know, realistically, to get back to, Cambridge.
Tom, you're not the one that slept all night in the ATM vestibule, are
no,
you?
No, no.
Oh, okay. That just seemed a little bit desperate to me. Thank you for the call. That's a great point, though. You want to be able to get out of work and not have to pay all that parking.
Hey, Martine, do you happen to know what the actual, this is published in your paper and the Herald virtually annually, what the actual cost of a ride on the T is roughly? Do you know what the cost is?
That's a good question. I think I'm not 100%.
Is it three?
Sure,
it's somewhere in the neighborhood. I think
it's
of $2. Three times. No. The actual cost, not
yeah,
how much
yeah,
it costs to ride.
It's definitely more.
It's
than
something
what
like
it,
three
what,
times
what
as much.
Is.
I mean,
yeah.
This is another situation where you know the results of the survey suggest people want to pay a lot more, including this guy who was just on the phone. And the answer is ask them to pay the actual cost if they really want it, and it costs X dollars divided up by prospective riders.
Right.
And there you have a break even. 877-301-8970. Are you for it, and are you willing to pay, and are you willing to fight for it? Bruce, you're in Newton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
At the beginning of the segment, Jim, you mentioned that we have maybe in terms of not only the country but the world, the T system that closes the earliest.
Did I say the world?
I
meant the United States, but okay.
You said potentially, I think.
Okay.
I needed to say that definitely isn't true. I lived in Japan for a number of years,
uh-huh.
And Japan pretty much universally, the last train is at 11 p.m.
Really?
Wow, so what do
yeah,
they do?
If you miss it and you live anywhere sort of outside the city, I mean, you're looking at a cab ride of like $130, $150. So we have it pretty good here, I got to say.
How do they justify that? I would think people in Japan would be pretty upset.
I don't know. I guess, I mean, when I lived there, I was a younger person, and I enjoyed going out.
Yeah.
And it was always a last-minute sprint to get to the train, you know, running from the bars. So
Bruce,
it would be nice. I can't see it ever happening here.
Bruce, I've read where they have these pushers in Japan
yeah.
when the trains are really crowded, and their full-time job is to shove people into the overcrowded trains. You ever see them in action?
You know, I never saw them, but I did live in Tokyo for a while.
Yeah.
And it definitely was uncomfortable.
Well, by the way, if you haven't ever seen, the video of that, Martine?
It's great.
It is real. It is almost Saturday Night Live-esque. It is unbelievable. But you know what's amazing? Bruce, thanks for the call. What's amazing is places like Tokyo are one of the late-night capitals of that part of the world, of Asia. It's so surprising that they... This is one of these no-brainer kinds of things. You know, one of the people who drives Tom Menino nuts is Greg Selko from Karmaloop and the Boston Future Alliance. This is one of the kinds of things that his organization talks about, is to make this a more user-friendly city for younger people, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, even 40-somethings. You have to make the whole city more accessible. How can it be more accessible if you can't afford a $40 parking space at a garage? The answer is you provide them tea service.
And we close earlier in general, don't we? A lot of bars are, certainly in New York, they're open until the wee hours, but we close at 1 o'clock, I think, a lot of bars here. Is there are many that close at 2? I don't even know.
I think some of them, yeah, a lot of them do close at 2, but I think that there's also an argument to be made that it's a chicken and egg kind of situation, that if you had the tea open later... then, you know, maybe there would be more people going out a little bit later.
Let's take a couple of more calls. Steve, you're in Auburn, and you're on with Martine Powers from the Boston Globe. Hey, Steve.
What's up, guys? I think that, you know, increasing the frequency of trains outside of Boston is going to be the primary role of the MBTA in the future. I don't think that lengthening the hours in Boston is going to be all that beneficial. It's going to be really expensive. It's going to hurt the taxi industry. It's going to result in gatherings of drunk kids in these T-stops. Is going to be a potentially unsafe environment. You know, so what if people are riding their bikes home? That's okay. It's just going to result in people outfitting their bicycles with lights and proper safety equipment. I can only see this being an unnecessary cost burden on Massachusetts to fund the partiers in Boston and hurt the taxi industry.
Oh, wow. You're a real spoil sport in the parties.
But, you know, he actually makes a cut. I mean, one, he does make a good point. Obviously, it's going to cut back on the income of taxi drivers and taxi fleet owners. But secondly, Steve, thanks for the call. Martine, how about the whole issue of it provides, I guess, an environment, and I'm paraphrasing what Steve just said. You can stay out later. You can drink more. And we were talking about it's a good thing because you don't have to drive home. But the downside is what Steve was just talking about a minute ago. Is that concerning anybody?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was concerning the people who answered this survey. It was a pretty self-selecting group. But yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of folks who are not too pleased to have kids running around at 2 o'clock in the morning, a little drunk, a little loud, and that this might, you know, possibly encourage that.
Very big smile on your face. You know, have you seen one of the things Beverly Scott showed me last night? Have you seen the brand new commuter rail trains, the double-deckers or something that are going to come into place in a couple of months? They're beautiful. And, you know, one of the things, if people saw newer trains that didn't squeak, as you say, going around at the Boylston stop on the Green Line.
They say it's impossible to fix it because of the tracks are too old or something.
But that would change them. Let's take one more quick one from Martine. Linda, on the road, wherever that might be, you're on with Martine Powers. She wrote the page one story in today's Boston Globe. Hey, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thanks.
I'd like to address something that was brought up at the beginning of your time. You were talking about the cleanliness of the trains, and I think that's something that really needs to be addressed. I travel around the country, and I have ridden in other cities, and they're gorgeous. But as she said, you get to New York and Boston, and they're filthy. I mean, I've gone as a business traveler and have passed up the opportunity to rent a car because I trust the Metro or the L. And I've also ridden in Europe, and, you know, they are a lot cleaner. I think the idea is, you know, not to focus on the drunk kids running around Boston at 2 o'clock in the morning, but the families that get out of the theater or a sports event or whatever and don't want to pay $35 or can't pay $35 for the garage, they want to ride the train.
Yeah, that's a great point, Linda. Thank you for the call. Why are our trains so dirty? Have you looked into that, Martine? Can you get to the bottom of that, please?
I have not looked into that.
Okay. You know, the city could always contract out to Feng Hua to do the 1-3 route. What do you think about that?
I think the whole bottom line here is, had tea workers historically had to work until they were 48 instead of 41,
we would
wouldn't
have had
be
late
in
night
such
service.
A financial mess as we are right now. Thank you very much for being with us, Martine.
Thank you.
Great piece today.
Great front page story today in the Globe about extending the hours of the MBTA. I think it's a great idea, even if it does cost us a little more. Okay, so what are some of the important stories that didn't make the front pages this week? Callie Crossley brings us that conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Is this the second day of spring, or what day of spring is this? Third, second,
I don't know.
Whatever
I get
it is.
Mixed up.
It's spring. Joining us in the studio, on first time she's joined us in spring, by the way, as she does every Friday, is the woman behind. Well, it's true. What are you laughing about? It's true.
Making her springtime debut.
Exactly. Is the woman behind the mic on her own Sunday night radio show, Under the Radar, with Kelly Crossley. Hello, Kelly Crossley.
Hello, Jim.
By the way, before we get to the subject du jour, you speak very well. I always admired your diction as someone who's challenged along those lines.
Can you address
the springtime issue? Is it crocuses? Croci, croci, what is the deal with that?
I thought it was crocuses, but
I thought it was crocuses too, but if you're doing the Latin thing, wouldn't it be croci or croci?
But I never did the Latin thing.
You
so
didn't.
Okay. No.
All right, there
so,
you go.
Can
go.
You speak to the Pope about that next time you were in his presence, Marjorie?
I was within 30 feet.
She was.
The Pope and the Pope Mobile. Yeah, I tried to get an autograph. It didn't work. So the GOP, according to Kelly Crossley, is going out of its way to recruit more voters of color. What exactly are they doing?
Well, not just according to Kelly Crossley, according to Rice
Rines Priebus.
I can never pronounce that man's name.
The chair of the RNC.
Yes, they have a 98-page, some people say 100-page report in which they gathered a committee of some known folks, the son of Haley Barbour, Henry Barbour, Ari Fleischer. You know, he was a former press secretary for one of the Bushes. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, names of folks and another woman whose name is escaping me now, who is a big strategist for the Republicans. And they, you know, got in a room and really talked to their folks and said, OK, what do we have to do here to be within the 21st century and having outreach, some serious outreach to minority communities? And they came out with this report. And the centerpiece of it is that they need to be up close and personal with folks to tell them about their policies. And they feel certain that if the policies are told to folks one-on-one in their own communities, this will work. So they're going to pay people, and you have a budget of $10 million to send people all around in various communities to be in those communities and to interact with folks, which is a piece of the Obama strategy. But I need to add that the Obama strategy had paid folks, but they also had folks in the community who were strategizing and trying to get other people to vote for President Obama.
But let's go back a step. Mm. So the implication, I have to say, I didn't read the whole report. I just read news accounts, is that it's because people of color don't understand what our policies are and we're going to explain them better, or that we're going to change some of our policies and then we're going to explain them. For example, you know, obviously this part of this comes in the wake of the drubbing in the Latino vote, and it was 71 to 27. And people like George W., as you well know, when he ran, I think the first time, his first election against Al Gore, got somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of the Latino vote. So obviously he was doing something right, whether it was as governor of Texas or as a presidential candidate. So are they saying they have it right, or they have to change it and communicate it better?
It's a little bit of both and. There's been no communication and no outreach. We can go back, and I discussed it on this program some months ago, post-election, looking at a really fine report by the Bay State Banner from folks saying they were frustrated around the Scott Brown campaign. These were black folks saying, I wanted to support him, but I didn't see him in my community. He was not here. Now, contrast that with an Elizabeth Warren who was at all the parades, all the meetings, all the whatever. And, you know, it's not enough for him just to come for the debates or whatever. It's for him to be here and interact and have folks who support him, who, by the way, are not paid. So they said, hey, we don't have a problem with paid folks coming. And there were some. And there's no problem with the billboards. And there were those. But we want to see him, and we want to see other people who are not paid who want to support him in the community.
You know, Scott Brown ran a pretty good campaign. What was the analysis of why he did not go into the community? That seems sort of a no-brainer, doesn't it?
Well, I've had that rare species, a black Republican who lives in Massachusetts, tell me he did not go to the community.
Oh, I've
and
heard
he
that
suggested
too.
It. And he said, I don't know why. We strongly suggested. Now, it has been said that, remember now, the presidential campaign anyway, the thought was that, you know, they'll tell everybody on the local level how to respond and what strategy. And their strategy was that we don't think we're going to get anything by going in those communities, so don't waste your time. And a lot of people were frustrated and angry about that.
Well, a lot of Republican analysts were criticizing Mitt Romney in the final month of the campaign, saying, go to the cities. Go to the cities. Even if you're not going to win cities, you can pick up enough votes that you might be able to beat this guy being the president of the United States. But as essentially that was a suburban and rural campaign against what was primarily an urban campaign. I'm not saying Obama wrote off anybody, nor that Mitt Romney wrote off anybody necessarily, but that was the distinction, a great distinction.
But when you see people in your community and they are, you know, fighting for that candidate, that has more resonance to you. As the Obama campaign team was fond of saying, our people said, I see the folks in the barbershop, I see them in the beauty shop, I see them in the grocery store, I see them at the doctor's appointment, and they know me, I'm a neighbor, and I am supporting President Obama, and that has resonance. So there's much to be said about the strategy of saying, let's get in those communities and let's talk our policies one-on-one. But there's a bigger issue here that they have to address.
What?
In the 98 pages, or some say 100, I guess that's the footnotes, there was no addressing of the racism that has been articulated by some. Now, I'm not going to say that's the whole party. I'm not here to say that. But there are some that have said it. And here's where folks get very upset. It's okay to expand the tent and have everybody in the tent, but who's already in that tent you need to address?
Like who? Who do you think?
Well, here's a good example. There was this African-American guy, K. Carl Smith, at CPAC. That's a conservative
political action committee in Maryland last week. Yeah.
Right. So these are, you know, super conservatives. He had a panel talking about outreach at the panel. And by the way, he's founder of something called the Frederick Douglass Republicans. That's in the name of a black abolitionist, Frederick Douglass. A guy got up and this went viral saying Frederick Douglass should thank the United States, you know, because in slavery they got food and shelter. This is a comment. I mean, and here's, you know, Carl Smith saying, what can I do with that? You know, come on. I'm here at CPAC. What are we going to do? What are we going to say to those people that say this kind of stuff? And that's the thing that really gets on everybody's last nerve. When these kinds of comments are made, there is silence from not only leaders, but from other folks saying, you know what, that's not acceptable. You don't represent me as a Republican. I'm not. Don't say that. That's not me. And what you know, if you've been paying attention to the whole bully, the bully research, which I like to point out to people all the time, the power that goes to the bully comes from who, Jim? The silent witnesses. So if you don't speak up and say anything, what am I to think if I am a minority voter about your interest in me?
Let's say, you know, you're talking about a bottom-up strategy where they actually have to go out and talk to real people, and they are saying the words as well. But it seems to me there's a trickle-down strategy, too. Having Marco Rubio, putting aside the content of where he is on the issue, we can debate that another day, having the Republican Party saying, this is one of the two or three most important leaders in our party, and as evidenced by the fact that he gave the response to the State of the Union, which is a pretty big deal. That really matters. What's the name of the new senator from South Carolina? Tim Scott, the black Republican from South Carolina. It seems to me you not only want, if you're the Reince Priebuses of the world, to be doing the grassroots kind of stuff that you're talking about, real contact, you also want role models in the party. I mean, one of the reasons I think that the Republicans were so happy to have Colin Powell, even if they were a little dicey about his position on some issues, is there was actually an African-American who was respected by virtually everybody in America, at least until he gave a speech to the Security Council at the UN.
And he still is a Republican, as he's made clear.
But he's an Obama Republican.
Well, but he said he's annoyed with, you know, the party for a number of these reasons, and one of them is what I'm talking about. You're exactly right. It has to be a both and. Of course there are role models. Of course people are looking at Marco Rubio. So they were also looking at it when Marco Rubio early on in the campaign said, here's my plan for immigration reform. And the rest of the party said, get out of here. You know, I mean, come on. That's what I'm looking at as well if you're trying to tell me to watch these people. And let me point out a very nasty little thing that happened at the Republican convention when the young legislator from Puerto Rico got up to speak and people said, you know, go home. Hello, she is home. You know, I mean, what are we talking about? So, I mean, this is what I'm saying. And no, I'm not hearing enough voices saying that's not representative of who we are.
But, you know, I mean, this is obviously a good thing for African-Americans or anybody else who's been taken for granted as black voters have been by the Democratic Party for years now. And, you know, many people would argue that the Democratic Party has not always served the interests.
Oh, I don't think there's any argument about that. I think nobody's arguing about that anymore.
Yeah, there'd be a choice here instead of it always being, you know, we got to vote for a Democrat because of the outrageousness of some of the Republican
positions. But you got to show up and you got to speak up.
By the way, I want to point out something to you. Earlier, I asked Kelly Crossley, who is Ms. Diction over here, whether it was croci or crocuses. Apparently, according to our crack production staff, It's both.
Really?
Really?
So
okay.
We can be correct either way.
You say there's no argument there on the issue we're discussing, Kelly Crossley. One place where there will be a big-time argument is Tuesday and Wednesday before the United States Supreme Court. Mm. Proposition 8, which is obviously the ballot question in California that defines marriages between a man and a woman, that's up, I think, Tuesday. And Wednesday is the Defense of Marriage Act, which says even if your state allows for a same-sex marriage, we're not going to give you federal benefits. That brought to us by Bill Clinton, interestingly, who now is arguing for its repeal. What's your sense, Nostradamus-like, of whether or not what I would assume is, most would agree is a conservative-leaning court, if they can basically reject the trend in public opinion, which is moving tsunami-like in the direction of approving same-sex marriage? Where do you think they end up on this and why?
I think it's going to be kind of like Hollywood films. You know how when the trend happens and then like 3 years later, there's a film about it. And you're like, oh, didn't that happen 3 years ago? I actually think, sadly, I would be shocked if they moved in the direction of public opinion. I just don't think it's happening.
Even on the Defense of Marriage Act, you don't think, as a court that seems to me to be a states' rights kind of place, it seems the opening for them is to say, we're not saying that we're for or against gay marriage. They find some reason to get around the Prop 8 decision. I don't know how they do that, but let's assume they do. However, if the state of Massachusetts or Iowa decides they want people of the same sex to be allowed to marry, then they shouldn't be denied benefits. Isn't that a good Solomonic splitting of the baby that even this court, I mean, they approved Obamacare, which no one thought they were going to do either, right?
Yeah, well, I just think on this one, I just think there's a lot more going on for some of the people sitting in those seats. That's just my opinion about it. I think, sadly, even though I think the fact, I know everybody's talking about President Clinton saying, you know, I'm sorry, I put that bill in place. Here's Hillary Clinton saying the same thing, blah, blah, blah. I think the biggest news for me about an organization that's come out and said, you know what, same-sex marriage is okay with us is the American Academy of Pediatrics.
That was great.
I think this is huge.
That was great. And talk about the parenting that they've seen of parents, of gay parents raising kids. What a great job they're doing. How great it is for the parents.
That was just a few days ago. People missed that. Yeah. That was just a couple of days
ago. You can't get any more.
Everybody loves pediatricians.
Yeah, I mean, if you got into the pediatricians now, and by the way, you know, this is an organization as well. So we're talking about a fairly conservative organization, takes its time making a decision.
Yeah.
And they said that we wanted to make sure our voices got out there before this vote. And still, I don't know that I think it's going to move in that direction. I'd be surprised.
Well, unlike President Obama, who's talked about his own children going to school with kids whose parents are gay and how wonderful these families are, I mean, unless we're talking grandchildren, we're not talking many people that are on the Supreme Court right now who have that kind of experience, too.
Well, I think there's others that have interacted with folk. We have Stephen Breyer right here. He's from the state of Massachusetts, where we have been leaders in that. But let's not forget that even as we're talking about this, in Rhode Island, they were up all night discussing whether or not they want to approve a bill to approve same-sex marriage.
This last holdout in New England for those who are not keeping count.
So it's kind of interesting that while we live in this kind of bubble here.
What about the black church? They have not been keen, a lot of the black ministers I know in Boston for years on gay marriage. It's changing, though.
Well, I think that when President Obama came out and made his statement and there was an opportunity for a lot of African-American ministers to come forward and say, we're not throwing him out because of this support. And by the way, I think this is okay, too.
Yeah.
It gave a lot of opportunity for folks to, be out in front. Now,
have they taken the opportunity? I mean, what drove me nuts when this thing...
Oh, no, they were. Yes!
They have.
Oh, my God.
Has that happened
everywhere.
Locally as well? Because
yes.
The black ministers historically, there was this moral equivalency argument that drove me out of my mind. The notion that when gays were arguing for something, both the gay civil rights bill, which obviously came in the late 80s, and this whole gay marriage push, the notion was that gay activists were comparing the plight of gays in the society to the plight of blacks through the years.
Well, I think that was an argument that, could be argued on both sides.
But why isn't there a legitimate argument to say blacks were discriminated against, gays are discriminated against, and the contest is not who's more discriminated against.
On both sides.
I mean, I think the bottom line is that when you have these discussions is that, we shouldn't be comparing whose pain is bigger.
Exactly.
Exactly.
I understand that. But at the same time, black folks have experienced a lot of stuff that, some gay folk just never are going to have to do. Particularly if you decide to be silent about being, which I don't have an option of being silent about,
But
who
you know
I am.
What I thought was the most compelling argument from the other side, from gay activists who said, yeah. But a black person never had the experience of being turned out of their own family, hated by their mother, hated by their father, because they were black as the whole family, or they may be different. You know, you may be lighter or darker and all that. And that was the experience of so many gay people, that they were rejected by their own family.
I would disagree with that. And there's all kinds of, you know, literature and commentary out there by folks who have had exactly that experience. But my point to you is that there have been opportunities, and particularly when President Obama made his statement, so many people wrote about it, spoke about it, talked about it, and said, you know, hey, let's go a different way. There was a great blog by a woman. It was, and I wish I could remember the title. It was very clever. It was something like, "Okay, Grandma, hold your heart. I'm going to just tell you what it's like now, and it's going to be okay on the other side."
Hey, Kelly, really under the radar with Kelly Crossley. I think you're aware of 6:30 Sunday night. Is this week three?
This is week three.
What are you doing?
We're doing a number of things, but one of the things that we're looking at is a story that features Arnani de Raju, who is a former city official. And this, what makes this interesting is that he now works for an agency in East Boston where they want to situate, as you know, a gambling facility. And he has come forward and said,
Suffolk
Downs, a lot of money is being spent there and nobody knows how much. And it's being targeted. You know, this is a community that could use an infusion of cash, hence Mayor Menino would like to see something situated there. And he's saying, I don't want to turn away money, but here is an opportunity that's ripe for corruption because nobody's talking about how much money is being spent. A lot of nonprofits are being targeted. They could use the money. I think this is dangerous, and we need to talk about it.
And just to be clear, when he says spend a lot of money, they mean spending a lot of money to win the battle for the Eastern Massachusetts casino against Everett and whatever. It's the M town. Is it Milford? I don't even know what town. One of the towns that begins with an M. So that's one of your stories Sunday night at 6:30.
Yes, and it's and he wants to put a cap on it, and some other things are going on with that story as well. So we'll be talking about that.
Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley, Sunday night at 6:30. Kelly, great to see you. We'll see you next Friday and listen to you Sunday.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Croci, crocuses.
Okay. I like croci.
Thank you, Jim. It was a book that made Philip Roth a literary rock star. It was also a book that generated no end of controversy. I thought for years it was the biography of Jim Browdy. We're talking about Portnoy's complaint. Philip Roth turned 80 this week. We'll look at how Portnoy's complaint influenced his work. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Thanks.
Right now, Boston Public Radio is in the middle of a very important fundraising campaign. But even though this program is coming to you fundraiser-free, it's still a great time to do your part, especially because right now, you'll be entered to win a once-in-a-lifetime adventure for two to Hong Kong, courtesy of the Hong Kong Tourism Board and General Tours World Travelers of Keene, New Hampshire. Call 888-897-9424 or enter to win when you give online at wgbhnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And A24, presenting the film Ginger and Rosa, directed by Sally Potter, starring Elle Fanning, Christina Hendricks, Annette Bening, and Alessandro Nivola, opens today at the Kendall Square Cinema.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Joining us in Studio 3 is Bernie Avishai. His latest book, great title, Promiscuous, Portnoy's Complaint and Our Doomed Pursuit of Happiness. Even he's laughing. Bernie, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for being with us. So you basically are arguing in your book, which has gotten great reviews, congratulations to you, for its brilliance and wittiness, that Philip Roth, that we've all misunderstood Portnoy's complaint. I was joking before that I thought it was the biography of Jim Browdy. I remember reading it.
I thought it was too,
actually.
As a young
woman and thinking, are all men like this? But you've argued that we've misunderstood it.
Well, first, I have to say about Philip that he brought what was in the back of our minds to the tip of our tongues, all of us. So
when you refer to him as Philip, so people don't think you're being he's a good buddy.
I've known him. We've been a close friend for 30 years, and I wouldn't have undertaken this book except as a labor of love. I mean, he helped me write it, and we talked, you know, often about the book. And he'd often default to Portnoy whenever I visit him you know, in Connecticut, I'd be in the bathroom. He'd be banging on the door. Bernie, what are you doing in there? You know?
How do we get it wrong?
No, I don't think people have it so wrong. I mean, the first way people go wrong with it is that they think that this is a confession in the form of a novel rather than the novel in the form of a confession. Really, Portnoy's Complaint is a very carefully constructed piece of satire. And the real interesting question about the book is, you know, who's the satire on? Most people originally assume that this is just Philip using the guise of this Portnoy character to tell the world what he really thinks about Jewish families, about women, about masturbation. Please, no liver jokes. We don't have to go there.
God, I'd forgotten some of the details until I was reading this morning. Oh, they all came rushing back.
However, what it's really about is
it is a book where a psychoanalytic confession is being overheard by a reader. And so it's very hard for us to know where to stand when we hear a psychoanalytic confession, because you never really know whether the family and the women who are being spoken about are the objects of the satire, or is the analysand the object of the satire? In other words, is all this raging stuff an example of how a certain kind of narcissism works its way out into a psychoanalytic conversation? And if you think about the stance of the psychoanalyst, this Dr. Spielvogel, who has the best punchline in literature, right after Portnoy goes nuts and cries for about three pages, and then he says, "And now maybe we please to begin." You know, it's like now let's start the conversation. You got it all out now. And so people naturally say, "Oh, well, maybe Portnoy is himself the object of the satire." And when Philip taught the book at Bard, he did say in his teaching notes, which he shared with me, that Portnoy is one of the major objects of the satire. But then you'd think, if Portnoy is the object of the satire, maybe Spielvogel is the guy we're supposed to valorize. We're supposed to think his stance is the stance we're supposed to believe is the sort of true stance for the reader. But then you realize that Spielvogel is also being skewered, because he seems to represent the most orthodox, unyielding, preposterous notion of psychoanalysis, which Roth was deeply impatient with. In fact, and this is sort of the backstory of the book, Portnoy's Complaint, and also the backstory that I reveal in my own, when Philip sat down to write Portnoy's Complaint, he had just finished an analysis with a fellow by the name of Kleinschmidt in New York, a kind of famous psychoanalyst to the stars. And he kept talking about his mother, and Spielvogel kept saying to him, "Oh, yes, your mother was very domineering, wasn't she?" And he'd say, no, my mother was so comme il faut, you know, there's nothing, and your father was very weak. You know, it's sort of every totem and taboo sort of reversed, you know. That was the thing that Kleinschmidt was trying to impose on Portnoy, that he was imposing on Roth. I'm also getting this confused. And Roth eventually said, no, you don't get it. I didn't have a domineering mother. I didn't have a weak father. Quite the contrary. But you know something? You've given me a better family than the one I really had for literature. In other words, it's easier for me.
Our number is 877-301-8970. That's the voice of Bernie Abishai. He's written a book, Promiscuous, Portnoy's Complaint, and Our Doomed Pursuit of Happiness. If you have questions about Philip Roth himself, who's 80, is he not 80?
Yeah, he just turned 80. 80.
Or if you have insight into Portnoy's complaint that you'd like to bounce off Bernie Abishai, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
You know, you just mentioned Philip Roth's real-life therapist. I wonder what he thought of Portnoy's complaint, because many people could assume it was a satire of the real-life therapist.
Yeah, well, there's a kind of sad story there, too, because what Kleinschmidt did was publish an article in a psychoanalytic journal in which he revealed things in Philip's story in this article, which then appeared in Portnoy's complaint, so that everybody knew, in a way, who this therapist was really talking about. I mean, he tried to disguise Philip. Instead of being like a Northeastern novelist, it was a Southern playwright or something like that. But then all the little vignettes that came out in Portnoy's complaint were revealed in this psychoanalytic journal. And Philip was tremendously chagrined by this. And in fact, when he wrote My Life as a Man, I mean, everything is material for Philip when it comes to these things. When he wrote My Life as a Man, he gives us this whole interaction between the therapist and the novelist over the therapist revealing all this stuff in a psychoanalytic journal.
What did you think of Portnoy's complaint? Did you read it in 69?
Oh, right? Sure.
Did you read it? What did you think of it in 69? Not now. What did you think of it then?
Oh, I thought, oh, my God, I could be so much more cool than I am. you know, I mean, like Philip, I was a nice Jewish boy. I was kind of square. You know, I felt that he had been reading my mind. But, you know, other people like Jim Carroll and others who are not Jewish boys but nice boys felt the same thing. You know, this was a book that I think had a tremendous effect on people precisely because it felt so true and complicated, you know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, the male identification with this, and in some case the female almost horror with this. I mean, I was sort of horrified, but you know, I was young and I didn't have any brothers. So, I mean, this is like, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. But let me ask you something, too. You talk about being a nice Jewish boy, nice Jewish family, all that kind of stuff. Philip Roth took a lot of grief from the Jewish community for not only this, but for, you know, Goodbye Columbus and other things. So, and you think that that was also unfair, that he was not trying to satirize, you know, the stereotypical domineering mother, weak father, Jewish family.
By the way, before you answer, I remember forums at my synagogue in Philadelphia, the sole focus of which was to excoriate Roth and the book for its portrayal of Jews in America.
Yeah. Well, the famous Gershom Sholem said, you know, Gershom Sholem, the historian at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, said, you know, what could be more horrible than for us to reveal the lust of a Jewish man for a Gentile woman in this way? And, you know, when the next, I mean, he didn't quite put it this way, but when the next Holocaust comes, we'll have started it here, you know, with this book. And I think quite the reverse happened. I think what happened was, you know, Portnoy became a kind of ticket getting punched by Jews into the mainstream of American life. It was, you know, oh, Jews are like the rest of us. Isn't that a relief? You know, it was that kind of a sense of exhilaration that you know, Jews also lust, Jews also masturbate, Jews also
they do
dissemble. Yes.
Well, hey, I want to play you a clip from Portnoy's complaint. Can we hear that for a second, then ask you a question? Here it is.
Why don't you tell me to change my clothes for some alley cat or a tree, because at least they exist.
If your mother was here now, if she wasn't sick in the hospital with her agony. One day a year, you ask him to do something for you. He's too big for it. He's too brilliant for it.
You're the ignorant one.
How does he feel about the film? First of all, Goodbye Columbus is one of my all-time movies ever. I've probably seen it a dozen times. How does he feel about Portnoy's complaint?
It was the worst film ever made.
Does he feel that way, or you feel
absolutely.
That way?
Absolutely. It was the worst film ever made.
And does he give... I'm embarrassed that I don't know. What sort of independence does he give up when someone buys the rights to his film? Obviously, he gives up plenty, yes?
A lot.
Okay, so I'll tell you a story about Patrimony. He sold Patrimony to CBS... And he told me that he wasn't sure whether he should do this. You know, Patrimony is the story of his father's death. And he said he went out to the graveyard where his father was buried. And he said, Bernie, I talked to my father. And he said, take the money. So he took the money. And then CBS said, we really want to have creative control here. But maybe instead of it being a father who dies, maybe it should be a mother.
Oh, gosh.
And instead of it being a Jewish guy, maybe we'll make him a Gentile so it'll have, a bigger swath of American mainstream. And instead of the father dying, the mother lives.
Oh, my God. Well, how about
they never made it.
How about Goodbye Columbus? I mean, lots of people love that movie. I thought that with Richard Benjamin. It was Ally McGraw, I think.
Yeah, no, he liked that film.
Yeah, that was a good one. That was
but
a good one.
They haven't made a lot of films of Phillips' books. He did. There was a rather good film made of The Ghostwriter.
Never saw that.
With his ex, Claire Bloom, so he doesn't watch it anymore, but... but the film made of The Human Stain, he didn't think much of.
And when's the last time you saw him?
2 days ago.
How is he at 80?
He was exhilarated from the party. He felt that the people who came to celebrate him had worked really hard to prepare very beautiful little essays, not just about his work, but about the meaning of literature. It was just, Edna O'Brien came and Jonathan Lethem. And
is he retired?
He's retired. He's not.
I was going to ask you why. He just said no more writing. That's it.
Look, writing a book is hard. When you're 80 years old, you have to leave yourself a sentence the night before and sort of think of it overnight and pick it up in the morning, and you have to do that for a year. There's a time to sort of hang him up.
Yeah.
And I think he's done that really intelligently.
But staying on that for a second, is he retired then because he wants to be or because he has to be? Is that what are you saying, Bernie?
He's retired because he wants to be. He has a wonderful biographer now, Blake Bailey, who's doing a biography of his not just of his life, but of his work. And he's spending a lot of time helping Blake understand the various books and the turns in his life that explain the books. He tells me, I used to think only about, women and prizes. Now I think about my next nap. And he loves it. He loves it. He said the Pope called him a couple of days ago to say, isn't it great? Isn't it great? Isn't it great? Yeah, it's great. We don't do nothing. We don't explain nothing. We don't have to make notes after every conversation. He's happy.
Well, do you think Philip Roth has gotten his due in the literary world? I mean, I know Portnoy's complaint is in a lot of these lists. You see Time Magazine and so forth.
Right.
It's up there in the best novels of the 21st century and stuff, or 20th century. Do you think he's gotten his due?
I think he is now. I think, he's almost never introduced without being introduced as America's greatest living author. But, authors die, and for many of them, their work dies with them. I don't think that'll happen with Philip Roth. I think that his work is sort of like the work of Dickens. It doesn't just chronicle our time, but it chronicles a whole human life. From childhood through to the anticipation and dread of the oblivion of death. And he writes, not all of his books have been great, but I would say a half dozen are truly great and punctuate a whole human life. And the best ones are written in his blood. I mean, he's that kind of author. He writes with his blood, and people know it and love him for it. I mean, the truth is, if I weren't his friend, I'd still consider him one of my best friends, even if I never even knew him.
If I can ask you about that, when you're sitting with Philip Roth, and I always wonder this when someone's friends with someone who is greatness, when you're sitting there just having a conversation with Philip Roth, do you ever step back and realize that you're in the presence of someone who, as you said, is recognized as maybe the greatest writer of his generation? You know what I mean?
Well, sure, to some extent. Of course, there's a kind of pride I take in having friends who have distinguished lives. I think everybody who's human takes pride in that. But the truth is, I got to know him in some pretty dark days when he didn't really feel like he was going to come back. And, you know, we've been close friends for 30 years. And if you go back 30 years ago, he had not really produced the great books of his latter career. So, you know, I love him. I just pull for him. I'm so proud of him. I'm really proud of him. I feel like he's a man who deserves the love that people have for him, and I sure have it.
You know, I just wonder, can you think of the kind of the people you think of chronicling Jewish life, if whether he was doing that or not? It's Philip Roth, and the next person that comes to mind in film, of course, is Woody Allen. Yeah. What does Philip Roth think of Woody Allen? The scene you just played from Portnoy's Complaint reminds me so much of the scene with Woody Allen asking his father the meaning of life, and the father says, "How the hell do I know? I can't even find a can opener," or something like that. You know what I mean? What does he think of him? Not much.
I don't think I like the answer to this.
I don't think I can. I don't want to speak for him.
Okay.
Let's just say he's been a friend of Mia Farrow.
Oh, well,
that's
good
a very
for
good
him.
Answer, Bernie.
Good
Abishai.
For him. After all his shenanigans, good for him.
Hey, Bernie Abishai, your latest book, "Promiscuous: Portnoy's Complaint and Our Doomed Pursuit of Happiness." Good luck with it, Bernie. Thanks so much.
Thank
for your
you.
Time.
Thank
to
you
see
very
you.
Much, Thanks. And congratulations for such a great book on the great Philip Roth. Up next is Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Buy a home and hang on to it. For years, that's been the way for families to build wealth.
That's just something you want to have in your family, to say that's home. You know, like coming to a rental property, that's not it.
First, though, you got to stop renting. I'm Kai Rizdahl, Rent versus Own, after the housing crash. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And New England Subaru, offering the Subaru Outback with symmetrical all-wheel drive. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com. That's subaruofnewengland.com.
Running rings around the moon.
This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's open mic time with Emily Rooney of Greater Boston, GBH Radio. Emily, you requested this song.
Do you know who sings that?
I have no idea what it is.
Guys, the theme song?
Yeah, it's the theme song from the Thomas Crown Affair.
Okay.
Oh, my God, that's right.
A windmill, like something.
Windmill's
something.
In your mind. Yes.
And why are we playing this?
Because the Gardner heist reminds me of this. It's just like this endless circle, and you don't really know who anybody is. There's this great line in there, the half-remembered names and half-remembered faces, and that's him. 23 years later, I'm doing it on Beat the
You know, Anthony Amore, who was the director of security, was
what
with me and
Emily.
What a
great name is that, huh? Anthony Amore.
He was with me and Emily, Emily and me, when you were in Rome, yeah. Marjorie, and one of the things that Anthony said to us was, he wakes up, I said, do you think about this all the time? He says, I wake up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you must wake
I
up.
Do.
In the, what is with
I
you in the Gardener?
I had this weird dream the other night. That somebody called me with the names of the two guys. I'm going, what? What? I couldn't hear the answer. What? Give me that again. What was it? How weird is this that people say they know who it is? I mean, Anthony Amore says he knows who it is.
All and he told us saying, that he thinks he knows it's the same people, Emily asked him this, as the feds, as the FBI.
Yeah, but says then, like, Kevin Cullen today had about 87 mobster names, everybody with an Eddie on the end. It was like, I couldn't figure out who any of those guys were. They're all, you know, intertwined between Boston and Philadelphia and Canada. And it's like, wow, I never even heard of these guys. So that's why the windmills of your mind, it just goes on and
on. Have you done any self-psychoanalysis? No, I'm serious about this. You are in the newsroom. You talk about it nonstop.
Know,
what is? I'm serious.
Well,
what,
my mother was an art history major.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm art historian.
Yeah.
So she was very much into, you know, art of the world, and I got a little of her knowledge, just a fraction. So I did know what these pieces, and I happen to think Rembrandt is the greatest artist who ever lived on the face of the earth. So the fact that one of his pieces is missing is like adds to the intrigue.
And where are they? I mean, that's the other thing about this.
They're in New England, according to Anthony.
But where are they? Are they rolled up in a?
He says they're not rolled up. I asked that question. He says they're not. You know, see, I'm fascinated by this. I want to know if the chips have fallen off. He says they're not rolled up.
So they can't
they
be on,
know
the,
exactly
they can't
where
be
they
on the wall somewhere.
They may be.
What do you mean they know exactly where they are?
Don't you think they know exactly?
Those are
this
big
is a
paintings.
Smoke screen.
How big is that
why,
Rembrandt?
Wait,
oh, there's only two
smoke?
Big ones.
How big is
the rest of them are tiny.
Okay. How big is the Rembrandt?
Oh, maybe 2x3. It's not that big.
But what are you saying? A smokescreen for what? Why would they not know? Why would they not want to congratulate themselves, go rescue $500 million in art and be celebrated throughout the world?
They're waiting for somebody to bring them to them. You know, they don't want to go on some big raid and then have somebody, you know, light a match to them. So, you know, I think they do know exactly where they are. You know?
So, but that is so bizarre, though. How could they be in the wall? I mean, the mailman would come by or something like that. I mean,
a lot of people, I don't know, I only know what I read from people like Anthony Amore. He said a lot of people do put them on the wall because it's their, although in this case, it sounds like it was really low level thuggery and probably not on the wall. Maybe
you mean
under
the thieves themselves you're talking about.
Yes.
So what do you make of this whole security guard? Steve Kirchner was writing about this in the Boston Globe.
I know.
He was in the picture they had of him in the Globe was so surprising. I guess he was a rock musician.
He's
so
a good looking guy now. I saw him on Channel 5 last night. He's like, wow, yeah.
With the curly gray hair.
Guy
Meanwhile,
now?
I get this tip. Everybody in the newsroom is laughing at me. I get this tip from this woman who lives on Marlborough Street. She's describing that guy, Abath.
Abath, I think. Whatever it is. Richard Abath.
To a tee. She says, oh, I rented out an apartment. She has this long wind-up. You know, she made her money in Italy, and then she came here, and she bought all these houses on Mission Hill, and she rented her apartments out to these guys who worked as security guards for Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum. And she said, you know, she tells me, I can't even get into the whole deal. She says, I told the FBI they should sweep that place for chips, and they just blew me off. But they told me, one of the guys told me he was in above his head, and he got out of there and he moved to Canada. Now that I'm thinking about it. And the girlfriend moved to Russia, so something was going on.
Well, then, you know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you for the last few days, and this is an opportunity to do it. Marjorie has the same question. What are you planning on doing with the $5 million?
Oh, no!
No, really. It is so, by the way, it is so obvious to me that Emily's intention, even if she doesn't admit it, is she is going to be, you're going to be the one to crack the case.
I'm going to buy a fantastic Picasso artwork. I'm going to buy a Rembrandt.
Wow, I guess. Okay, you had a great interview last night with...
And speaking of the gardener.
Well, you actually asked him about the garden. Let's play that.
I did. In fact, I forgot to ask it, and I said, no, I really want to know what he... This is Mayor Tomenino.
Well, because were you not criticizing public officials on this show the other day, saying, why aren't they making a bigger deal out of it?
Originally, when it happened, public officials really did nothing. Menino was not mayor. It was 23 years ago. But nobody really made a big deal. The gardener did, and the media did, but you know there was not a big hue and outcry with public officials.
So here's Emily's exclusive last night from Greater Boston with the mayor. Listen,
give us the names. That's what we should be. What's the secret about? Well, we know the names, but we're not going to tell anybody. Well, it doesn't help us.
I love that. I just love that. He's taken on the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office. He's saying, this is not a help. Give us the names, and then maybe we all could really help
you. How can they, though, give them the names?
Why not?
Well, I don't know. Isn't there a libel issue? Maybe the FBI can't be liable.
If they charge him,
they haven't charged anybody. If they charged him, it would be different.
Well, they actually can't charge them.
They could release
mug
shots. They could release drawings, what do you call those things, artist renderings. Why not? They do that all the time. We're looking for people who look like this. Why not?
That's an excellent point. Yeah. Why could they not do that?
You said, I'm quoting you to you repeatedly, to yourself repeatedly, a couple of weeks ago when John Connolly kicked off his campaign. I don't know if it was on the same day he did it and he was here or subsequently. You said something like, this guy's the real,
deal.
I think he's got a shot or something like that. You spent, an hour with Menino yesterday. How'd you come away
and
from that?
And I spoke to him before and after at length. He was very chatty. He was very feisty.
Wait, who's he? Connolly?
Mayor Menino.
Oh, Menino.
He looked fantastic.
He did look fantastic.
He wasn't that mobile. But he was in really good spirits. He was fed. He was really, anxious to talk about. He kept bringing up John Connolly even without my prompting. He was feisty of that. He was defensive about his position with what happened with Boston schools. He kept saying, John Connolly doesn't have a record to stand on. All you have to do is look at my record. I mean, he sounded like a guy running to me.
Yeah, he sounded like a guy running to me, too, absolutely. But he kept saying, what is his vision, when he was talking about what is Connolly's vision for the waterfront, what is Connolly's vision? I was thinking to myself, well, what is Mayor Menino's vision for the waterfront? I'm not sure.
The vision is happening.
I guess. Mm. Yeah, a lot of
retail restaurants.
Christopher Lydon was here yesterday saying it looks like the back end of... some fish truck or something. He was not very impressed with what the waterfront was looking like.
Well, I've been critical of the waterfront, too, because I still contend it's hard to get to, even by T-Jim. It's just like, you still got to get into a car and drive there. I mean, but it's coming together, and, there are certain areas of it. It's still hard to see the water. I always say, what waterfront? It's like you're going over there. It's like, I don't see the water, unless you're, on the window in Legal Seafood.
Looking out the window at the federal courthouse, which is so
ridiculous.
Outrageous that we have blocked off that whole
access.
Well,
that was one of the first major structures, the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston. And that complaint was made
on the water
by a lot of people. I don't know if you're aware of this. Last night, while you had Tom Menino, I had Beverly Scott, the general manager.
Yeah, yeah.
She lived in town 3 months.
Know.
Do you know that she knows that you don't ride? No, on my honor.
Did
that
you
is
say it on the air?
No, not on the air. But we did have, I won't go any further, but we did have a small discussion about your non-tea.
Oh, now it's become a...
Okay, so Connolly was the
and
real...
And plus, it closes too early for me. I'd never be able to get, because I keep such wild hours.
Exactly. Well,
late.
Martine Powers
close
wrote about
those bars at 2 p.m.
Hey, Emily, so Connolly was the real deal when he announced. I assume you think Menino is the real deal from last night. What's your assessment of the race now that you've sat down with a guy?
Mayor Menino is going to have a tough time physically running, and I mean that in the literal sense, because... Getting around, whipping around to venue, standing on a stage for a long time.
And that's so much of who he is, that person-to-person contact.
So unless something dramatic happens with him physically in the next couple of weeks, I'm not really sure I see that. He said he's got some problems with his leg, his hip. I didn't get into the personal aspects of it, but and they're modifying his home in some way to accommodate that. I mean, he can't, for instance, get himself out of a chair. Unassisted. I mean, he really struggles. And I'm talking about like a little straight back chair. Because he's got this cane and he really struggles to get out of it. And usually somebody helps him up.
You know, he's doing massive amounts of physical therapy.
Yeah.
But, you wonder, you're right.
Yeah,
about
twice a day. And he also, he told me that his diabetes is under control. Like the numbers have gone way, way, way down. He wouldn't tell me how much weight he's lost. I don't know why, what the big deal is there. But, weight is definitely, there's a correlation there between weight and diabetes. I don't know if this will make it disappear, but he's definitely lost a substantial amount of weight.
Well, Emily Rooney, I know you're not quite as passionate about other things as you are about the Garden Museum, but I did hear you this morning talking about, up in the newsroom, you're a little upset about the consortium and the debate moderators, that they're not...
Why don't you explain what the consortium is for people that don't know?
The consortium is this sort of varying group of, it's a media conglomerate. Usually the Boston Globe is in it. This year they've broken off and they're just with WBZ. But there's still a ton of us in it. Channel 7, Channel 4, WGBH Radio, WGBH TV. I think there's seven.
NECN, thank you very much.
There's seven or eight of us in
it.
And we usually sponsor at least one round of preliminary debates and one round of final debates. And, it's called, everybody carries it at once. So it's kind of like there's no place else to go when you turn on TV, radio, whatever. There it is. But... there's just this ridiculous rule that no one who's a member of the consortium can be the moderator of the consortium. So if WGBH or NECN, Jim Browdy can't be a moderator, Emily Rooney can't be a moderator, because no one wants someone recognizable on the other guy's air, which I think is ridiculous. If we started rotating this and, you know, took turns and one of us, first of all, we know the issues better. We are well known to the audience. We keep recruiting these people who come in. They mispronounce names. I mean, John Canning is always fantastic. He's a local guy. But people come in, they mispronounce the names of the candidates, the towns. They're not really steeped in the issues. They're studying like crazy, but then they don't know the background of it. We got to just give this up.
Well,
why can't you just change the rule?
Well, first of all, there's no rule. This is, and by the way, this is not a candidate mandated
thing.
No, not
at all.
The consortium,
Why can't the consortium just change?
I think that argument
has been made. I think Linda Pollack from WGBH says, "Look, guys, this is ridiculous. Why can't we just take turns?"
Exactly.
Or have somebody who's more benign. I don't know. Because I guess they're afraid they're going to put somebody like Andy Hiller, who's really out there. Although I think Andy Hiller would be fantastic.
So do I, actually.
But then somebody becomes controversial. Oh, yeah, well, you put somebody out there that's controversial, and then we don't want
that. I think it's about what you said before, is they don't want the face of a joint debate to be the face of some other station's political operation. By the way, this thing that's happening next Thursday,
Wednesday at 7.
Half hour of each, Democrat and Republican, am I right about that? Is R.D. Saul, who's no longer formally an NECN anchor.
Which is why he's acceptable.
That's exactly right.
And he's worked at NECN, he's worked at Channel 7.
Yeah.
And he's worked at, I think, a couple of other stations maybe. But so I guess he's suddenly totally acceptable. He'll be fantastic.
So why hasn't, I'm surprised. I didn't know there was this sort of passion in you. I feel exactly the same way for selfish as well as selfless reasons.
Yeah.
So why hasn't it happened?
Just the reason, because it's so petty. It is so petty. The executives who run these outfits don't want you on Channel 7. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Or Natalie Jacobson. Even Natalie now would be unacceptable because she's so well-known and well-identified with WCBB. Oh, Natalie would be great.
She would be great. She would be great. And you're right. It is so annoying. There will be some issue
that has
been huge in the papers and on television locally. And you get to the debate and someone from out of town never even asks about it. It drives
me insane.
They don't know or that hasn't been part of their little packet of homework, so they're oblivious to it.
Is it true? You were, Marjorie handed me a note before, you are moderating the debate on the Gardner art theft. Are you not? No, is that?
I'd like to.
Every station agreed that you were the one. They said, we know she's GBH, but it's
fine. You must have a theory.
I'm just going along with what everybody is saying now, that it was low-level thugs, that there was never any grand international intrigue.
Is there a Whitey Bulger connection here?
No.
You don't think so?
I asked that question.
Or Miles Connor, darn it.
No.
Miles O'Connor.
That was wrong too. Do you think that
I had Miles on the show a couple years ago asking about that?
And what do you make of the security guard that has been requestioned, with the theory being that he maybe monetary reasons
he
or whatever?
Came off incredibly
that was Steve
Kirchner's
story. We should say he
Steve
was with
Kirchner's
us.
Story.
Yeah, and the suspect motions that this guard made, from opening the door for his footsteps, the whole thing. But he was explaining. He didn't – whoever was interviewing him, as Jim pointed out, wasn't really interviewing him on the details. But he came off, I thought, very credible.
I thought so, too.
Like, very believable.
No, but wait. But you're casting that aside. Like, other than that, the reason it came off as credible is because two of the pieces of evidence uncovered by Steve Kirchner, the CNN reporter – I can't remember her name – never even broached. One, that he opened the side door.
No, but the Channel 5 reporter did ask.
Oh, I didn't see the Channel 5. I'm talking about CNN. The side never mentioned opening the side door, which allegedly was – That's a great point. A non-local reporter. And secondly, never mentioned the fact that the motion detectors in one of the rooms only detected his footsteps as opposed to one of the two faux cops.
That was a weird thing about the footsteps and the motion detector only having his steps. What do you make of that?
He told a straightforward narrative that seemed believable. That's all I know. And also, if he were that guilty, would he be doing interviews?
No, that's the other thing. And I also thought if he were that guilty, he would never have worn that outfit tonight. He had a pair of bright red pants and some weird, like 1960s
rock and roll. Still looks like Jerry Garcia.
Yeah.
With the big curly hair.
He does. He looked ridiculous down when they showed the picture of him down there with his...
While you were talking, I just did some math. You could take the whole newsroom to Aruba and you'd still have $4.2 million left over.
Yeah, that would be a generous gesture on my part.
What are you doing on Beat the Press tonight? Marjorie is part of your cast of characters.
Yes, I am. I'm very excited.
What are you doing
there? Well, we are going to do, you'll be hearing that tune again.
Gardner Heist.
Well, only because it has created so much intrigue in the media. So it's the, circle in a spiral. But we're also on a more serious note. We're taking a look at some of the press coverage of that Steubenville rape conviction and how certain members of the media were sympathetic to the defendant, saying, you know, these two boys, 16 years old, promising careers, great football players, their lives are over, and whether that was appropriate, even if true. So we'll be looking at that and a couple other things.
Okay, she's Emily Rooney. Tonight at 7 o'clock is Beat the Press, my favorite show every Friday.
Especially when you're on.
Yeah, well, I don't like when I'm on because then I think my hair looks wrong and stuff like that. But anyway, tune in Monday. This is Open Mic with Emily today. Tune in Monday for Open Mic with the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Coming up, we have GOP candidate Gabriel Gomez joining us to discuss his run for United States Senate. That's next on WGBH 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
This hour of Boston Public Radio is coming to you fundraiser-free thanks to Faith in Newton.
And Ryan in Swansea.
And Rachel in Somerville.
And the thousands of other WGBH sustainers who keep this station going with small monthly contributions that automatically renew.
When Boston Public Radio can count on your support, you can count on less time fundraising and more Boston Public Radio.
It's easy to sign on as a sustainer. Just call 888-897-9424.
And thanks.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Gentle Giant Moving Company, celebrating more than 30 years of moving antiques and art, including local moving, long-distance moving, full-service storage, and art and furniture restoration. More at gentlegiant.com. And Xfinity Home from Comcast, the new home security and home control solution from Comcast, combining 24/7 professional monitoring and online management tools. Xfinity Home. More at xfinity.com/home.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browder. She is Marg Regan. He is one of the three Republicans who wants to succeed John Kerry. He's a former Navy SEAL, and he's with us in the studio. Pleasure to meet you, Gabriel Gomez.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you for coming in. Now, before we get to policies and politics, just a couple of quick questions here. Some people have compared you to sort of the non-Cosmo Scott Brown. You're a very handsome man, Gabriel Gomez. You mentioned before you have a flight jacket, although you didn't wear it today. He is, of course, of the barn coat. You think those comparisons help you in the state, which is not big on Republicans? What do you think?
Well, like, I think Scott Brown's an amazing person. I thought he was a great senator. And I welcome, you know, anything comparable to a popular person. He's the most popular politician in Massachusetts, from what I've read.
He absolutely is. So they sort of help you. Another thing before we get to politics or policies. I read where you were one of only two people who went from landing planes on aircraft carriers to a Navy SEAL. Is that correct?
That is correct. When I went through, there was one other gentleman who had already done that. And it was a big move when I went from being a pilot to going through SEAL training. I was told by my commanding officer and all my friends that, hey, look, you know, you've got less than 1 in 5 chance of making it. And the Navy was pretty explicit, saying that if I didn't make it, I wouldn't have been able to go back and fly and keep my wings. But I didn't want to have any regrets when I look back on life, so I went forward and I made it through SEAL training.
One last thing about the airplanes landing on the aircraft. So how many feet do you have before you go right over the side into the water? I mean, there's not much. When you see those on television, it's amazing. It's almost like they're on the end of an elastic.
Right. I mean, an aircraft carrier is just a little bit over 3 football fields, a little bit over 1,000 feet, and it's got 4 cables going across, and you want to hit the third cable. If you hit the first cable, that means you're pretty close to the stern of the ship. You hit the fourth cable, that means that you're pretty far towards the bow. So you want to hit the third cable. There's not a lot of room for error.
No, there's not a lot of room for error. You ever hit anything other than the third cable?
Of course.
Hey, Gabriel Gomez, the first thing most people learned about you, at least publicly, other than your friends and colleagues and that sort of stuff, was that you'd written a letter to Deval Patrick saying, hey, make me a moderate Republican, the interim senator, and instead of you didn't know Mo Cal was going to be the person, he rejected it. Some people are saying this basically disqualifies you as a real Republican in a primary. Other people, like Joan Vernocchi, wrote in the Globe, hey, we're all looking for bipartisanship. This is bipartisanship. Looking back, if you had it to do over again, would you have written that letter to Deval Patrick?
Look, the governor, I thought, had a very unique opportunity to reach across the aisle and appoint a Republican to go down, who's willing to go down to D.C. and work on the hard issues and reach across the aisle and do the work for the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Now, I don't look at things through a political lens. I'm not a career politician. Maybe I was a little politically naive when I wrote the letter, or maybe too idealistic. But, you know, I want to serve. I started my career in the military serving, and I rose my hand. I raised my hand and I wanted to serve again, and that's why I'm running.
But you did you not say, either in a letter or in a comment about the letter, that if you had gotten the interim appointment, you wouldn't have sought the full seat, correct?
If I would have had the interim appointment, I would not have ran in the primary. That's
so how
correct.
Does that fit in your... I mean, real, no disrespect intended to Mo Cowan or Paul Kirk when he succeeded Ted Kennedy when he died. I mean, serving for a few... How does that fit into some notion of service to the people? Why would you have disqualified yourself if your real goal was to serve the people of Massachusetts and the country? I don't get it.
Yeah, I disrespected the fact that I understand what Governor Patrick was going to look at when he, you know, when he was considering who was going to be the interim senator. And I respected the fact that other people before me had taken the same, you know, stance, saying that if they get the interim appointment, that they weren't going to run in the primary. So I thought that I would be able to go down there during that interim period and be an effective senator for the people of Massachusetts.
Okay, so clear up for us. I know you've done it in the past, but maybe a lot of listeners of this show haven't heard it. In the letter, you said, quote, I supported President Obama in 2008. Subsequently, you said, no, I voted for the Navy guy, meaning John McCain. In the letter, you said, quote, I support the positions President Obama has taken on these issues, meaning gun control and immigration, but in fact, you oppose an assault weapons ban. So... A common usage of that language. When I hear someone say, I supported President Obama, it means to me I voted for him. You said it doesn't. Common usage of I support these positions means I actually support what he stands for. You say that isn't what you meant either. I mean, do you understand how some people are saying that just doesn't, that's not credible?
Like I said, I'm not a career politician. I don't look at things through a political lens. Somebody else may have written the letter differently. What I meant by I supported President Obama means I donated to his primary campaign in 2008. And that was it.
How about I support the positions President Obama has taken on these issues like gun control? What do you mean by that?
Sure. You know, I'm finally heartened that the president has raised these to a national level. And there are some positions on immigration, on gun control, some of the positions that I do agree. And there's other positions that I do not agree. And you mentioned some of them, such as the assault weapons ban and the minimizing the number of rounds in a magazine from 30 to a lower number.
Why would you not? So forget assault weapons for a second, which I know is really controversial. Even Harry Reid doesn't really support it, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. Why would you not support a ban on high-capacity magazines, the kinds that we know have been an intimate part of some of the worst mass murders in this country? Why would you not support that? What's the need for a Second Amendment believer to have those things?
Look, I'm a firm believer in the Second Amendment and the Bill of Rights, and I think what you need to do is you need to address to make sure that we have the proper background checks that are tied to mental health so that the people who pass those actually can have a weapon. I mean, I can take you to a range right now. I've shot all these weapons. I can take you to a range right now, and I can teach you how to switch out magazines in 5 minutes and become proficient. It's not the number of rounds in a magazine that is causing the problem, or actually the assault weapon that's causing the problem. It's the fact that we have people that are not able to pass a mental health test and a background check that have the weapons. And if we have, that's the problem we have to deal with right now.
But just one last thing. I'm sorry, in the magazines, but correct me if I'm wrong. My recollection of the Gabby Giffords shooting is when the shooter was actually trying to reload the magazine.
That's when he was tackled.
That he was tackled. Had he been able to have a higher capacity, there would have been more carnage. There might be a dead Gabby Giffords. So there, it seems to me, is one indisputable example of how the capacity of the magazine has a direct impact on the outcome of the deadly work of a killer.
But in that case also, if we'd had a proper background check with the mental health compared to it, he would not have had the weapon in the first place. So that's the part that we need to focus on first.
Well, let me ask you, when you ask about background checks, if you go up to New Hampshire with Gun Show, as you know, there are the licensed dealers that have one set of rules, and then there are the private dealers. So would you be in favor of getting rid of those private dealers so that I could not go up to New Hampshire without even a license in some cases and get whatever I wanted?
No, What I support is making sure that you have a background check on the gun show loophole and
okay.
tying it to mental health. That's what I support. I don't support the universal background check, but I think it's
because
wrong.
The universal background check would allow anybody. I could go up there. I mean, I did. People could have sold me anything up there without any kind of background check. You're okay with that?
No, I don't support the universal background check. I don't support a federal database. What I support is closing that gun show loophole and making sure that there is a background check on that. I think that it's wrong that it's easier to go up to a gun show and buy a weapon than it is to go buy a six-pack of beer if you're 21 years old and you go into a package store.
Okay.
I think you should close that gun show loophole.
So, in other words, there'd have to be some kind of background check at gun shows all across the board with even private dealers?
Yes.
Okay.
And you'd have to I suggest that you also tie it to mental health.
Okay.
There's still 20 states out there that don't tie their mental health data to the VIX system.
You have also described yourself on your website as a new kind of Republican. What do you mean when you called yourself a new kind of Republican? What does that mean?
Look, I'm not a career politician. I, uh, You know, I'm a first-generation American. I learned Spanish first. You know, I served my country. And I can go into the urban areas, and we spend a lot of our part of our campaign right now hitting all parts of Massachusetts. And we're getting into parts. We're trying to make the party more inclusive as opposed to exclusive. Uh-huh. And we're going into the urban areas. I can speak Spanish. I go into, and sometimes I speak Spanish all day into a lot of the areas that we're campaigning. And that's the part that we're trying to expand the party. We're also trying to expand the party by saying things about what we support as opposed to what we're against. And that's what I mean by a new republic. I'm going out there trying to expand the Republican Party and broaden it and expanding it on the core Republican principles, which are greater personal responsibility, more personal freedom, smaller, more effective government. And that's what I'm trying to do by saying we're a new Republican Party. We're trying to expand it.
What's
your ideal immigration situation in the United States of America?
I'm the son of immigrants. My parents came here, and they became citizens 20 years after they were here. And they went through all the proper procedures when they were here. And I'm finally heartened that after 25-plus years that there's been some kind of discussion on immigration reform, that we now have 8 bipartisan senators that are discussing immigration reform. Now, any discussion has got to start with securing the border. And I'm with Marco Rubio, who's one of those 8 bipartisan senators, in that you secure the border and you also have some pathway to citizenship. And this pathway can't be easy, but it also can't be impossible. And there also has to obviously be a background check. If there's a criminal record, you send them back. And they don't cut in line. They don't get any kind of special privileges. But there has to be some kind of pathway for those 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants that want to become U.S. citizens.
Right.
At least have some kind of certainty so there's a pathway.
In the same bill, not border security bill, then when it's secure, do a pathway. In the same, a comprehensive
It needs to be a comprehensive bill. Okay. It needs to be tied together.
I want to go back to your personal freedom thing. You're pro-gay marriage, are you not?
Look, I don't believe in any kind of discrimination. I think that if two people are in love, they should be able to get married.
So would you file an amicus brief in the Proposition 8? Proposition 8 of California, for those who don't know, was the proposition that the ballot question that said marriage is between a man and a woman. It is one that gives the Supreme Court the potential opportunity to essentially declare all of those state constitutions, 30-some, that say you can't have a same-sex marriage. Would you support the overturning of Proposition 8 and making same-sex marriage legal throughout the country?
Look, I think it should be decided state by state. I'm proud that Massachusetts was the first state that legalized gay marriage, and there's been, I think, 8 or 9 states that have followed, including the District of Columbia. So I believe that it should be decided state by state.
But even though you say you're against discrimination, isn't what those other you'd be a senator of the United States if you're elected from Massachusetts. Those 30-some states that constitutionally are prohibiting same-sex marriage, aren't they discriminating against people who say, I love a person of my same gender, and they can't have the same rights that you and your wife have, aren't they?
Yeah, like I said, I'm against any kind of discrimination, but I do believe that it should be decided by the state on a state level.
Let me ask you another thing about that being the new kind of Republican. I think you have said that Roe v. Wade is settled law.
Look, I'm Catholic. I was raised Catholic.
Yeah.
I'm pro-life. I'm personally pro-life. But I'm not going down to D.C. to change the law. Justice Scalia has come out. I mean, 40 years of presidents, I think, establishes it as law. And Justice Scalia has come out, who's a very conservative justice, and has taken the same view that it's established law.
Well, as you know, the Republican platform every year for years now has had one of their big issues that they want a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe v. Wade. So if you were in a position, if you were to become the United States Senator, to be asked to vote on something like that, where would you vote?
If it entails amending the Constitution, then I'm not for that.
Okay. So you're pro-life. Are you a Biden pro-life guy? I mean, Joseph Biden, Vice President, said he's Catholic, he's pro-life, but he's not going to impose his pro-life views on other religions or people who think differently. Is that about where Gabriel Gomez is?
Look, I'm a Gabriel Gomez pro-life person.
Okay. Okay, you're a Gabriel Gomez person. We're talking with Gabriel Gomez, who, of course, is running for United States Senate. I should give the number one more time because we only gave it once. If you do want to call him and ask him a
couple. We're not taking calls.
Hey, Forget that I will not give the number.
Gabriel, we're talking to Gabriel Gomez, as Marjorie said. Bipartisanship is one of the things you're selling. And I think if you polled the American people, one of the few things they actually agree upon is this is the most partisan, dysfunctional Congress ever. Budgets are one of the examples of inability to agree on anything. Let's sequester, for example. Give us, in short form, how does a Senator Gomez craft a bipartisan solution, for example, to the sequester? What's it look like that allows Democrats to buy in and Republicans to buy in?
I mean, the sequester is actually, or the sequestration is actually a perfect example of what's wrong down in D.C. You know, when you can't deal with a 2.4% cut on the growth of the budget, you know, I think if they can't deal with that, then they should resign and come home. That's a small part of what we're going to have to be dealing with down the road. So my proposal would be, or my approach would be that, look, we've already taken a balanced approach. We've already raised taxes on the top 2%. We've already raised taxes on everybody else because of the payroll tax. And now we can deal with the spending side. But you've got to be thoughtful but also considerate and reasonable about how you're going to approach the spending side. And there's not a lack of ideas down in D.C. There's just a lack of courage. And you've got to find the people that are going to have the courage to actually step up and do what's right for the American people.
But how is that bipartisan? It's obviously, as you well know, both the president and the vast majority, not all the Democrats in Congress, say there's got to be a mix, just like there was on the fiscal cliff. There's got to be a mix of some loophole closing and some serious cutting. If your position is we should figure out a way to cut 2.4%, I know you don't want to harm the military effort. I've read that on your website. What's bipartisan? That seems to be the Republican. So I don't mean that critically, by the way. Factually, that's the Republican solution, not the bipartisan solution.
Yeah, I would argue that it's not just the Republican solution. It's the American people. I mean, the people of Massachusetts. We've been going out there and going through all the parts of Massachusetts, whether it's Central, Western, North Shore, South Shore, the Cape, wherever. The one thing that they've come to me and said, look, we need to deal with the $16 trillion debt, and we need to deal with the fiscal stability of the country, and we need to deal with the spending side. That's been the top two or three things that people have come back and said to us. So that's not just a Republican point of view. I think it represents the people of Massachusetts.
You having fun doing this, by the way? I don't mean this. You having fun? I mean, seriously.
Jim,
you having fun doing this?
I have a very important question.
Oh, what is
here?
It? Is this another Scott Brown question?
No.
I got a couple things to say. I saw that I hope you saw what we tweeted. That I hope your brackets.
No.
Oh, we tweeted that. Hopefully, your brackets on the NCAA March Madness are better than your political progress.
I said this in the tease before Gomez came in the room. I predicted last Friday after this flaccid letter that Gabriel Gomez would pull out by last Monday, and I was wrong by a couple of days, wasn't I?
You know, maybe some of the instructors during SEAL training didn't think I was going to start Hell Week.
Yeah.
But as class leader, I finished Hell Week.
Speaking of SEALs, I'm dying to know. Did you see Zero Dark 30 about the Navy SEALs? What'd you think of it?
I did see Zero Dark Thirty, and it's a Hollywood movie. But I have to be upfront that I really don't talk about any of the SEAL kind of operations or any of the things that are going on with the SEAL teams.
And why is that so important? Because, of course, a couple of the SEALs have, as you well know, talked about the capture of Osama bin Laden. But why is that? Why do SEALs have that rule?
It's a code that we live by, and you know we're silent professionals. We're very proud of what we do, and we do a great job. And they continue to do a great job, but it's not something that we need to go out and put out in the public. You know, we've got a lot of bad guys still out there, and they're able to connect dots. Any little dot that you, any kind of information you put out there, they're able to use to their advantage. And that not only puts our SEALs at risk, but our forces at risk, but it also puts our SEALs' families at risk as well.
Hey, Gabriel Gomez, really appreciate you coming in. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for being with us. Gabriel Gomez running for United States Senate on the GOP ticket. So, what do narcotics dogs and Olympic gold medalists and President Barack Obama have in common? They are all fair game on our Friday news quiz. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
The verdict is in for two teens accused of rape in Steubenville, Ohio, but the jury is still out on how the media covered the case. The Barbershop Guys talk about complaints that the coverage was too sympathetic to the accused. Also, they'll talk about other important stories this week. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health. And the New Bedford Whaling Museum, presenting the Art of the Ship Model, a new exhibition exploring marine models as a true decorative art form, located in historic downtown New Bedford. More information at whalingmuseum.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Bradley. She is Marjorie Egan. It's time for our Friday news quiz. Here's this week's contestants. Peter Kadzis, soon to be unemployed, is executive editor. It is what it is.
That's charming.
Next Friday at this time, I will be a member of the 47%.
Oh, my God. Of the great Boston Phoenix. And I didn't mean to make light of it because Marjorie and I are both huge fans of both Peter and the Phoenix. Elena Zubareva. She's an opera singer, a voice expert. And, you know, Elena, first of all, it's great to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise.
What are you? I understand you do voice coach. I'm actually going to ask you to coach the three of us at some point before you leave today.
I've already been several times to no avail,
you
Jim,
teach,
voice coaches.
When Chelsea, our colleague, said you teach safe screaming to fans
things,
of the different teams?
Yep, I
what
do.
Does that mean in English? What is safe screaming?
Well, first of all, before I answer this question, I have a question for you. Did you call us contestants?
I think I did.
Contestants.
Oh, so are we like in a battle of some sort?
You're in a battle.
What do we win?
What do we win? You win a job, Peter. I don't know about... Okay, so...
Well, that sounds good.
What does that mean, safe screaming, as opposed to unsafe screaming?
Well, actually, seriously speaking, there are lots of issues with voices in this country, and people do scream incorrectly, and they heard their voices, and then they can't speak next day for their job.
Like Bill Clinton. He was always hoarse.
But, you know, Bill Clinton has other issues. I mean, God bless his heart. I never met him, and I'm sure he's a wonderful person. But when it comes to his voice, he lowers it artificially, which actually is also bad for the voice. He also probably has some health issues that go along with the voice, but...
He does that to make himself more masculine?
Precisely.
Really?
But you know what, actually, it's not just men that are doing this. Women do it a lot. And because women have been doing it a lot and hurting their voices, there is actually a real symptom that has been recognized by the doctors. It is called Bogart-Bacall syndrome.
Ah.
Yep.
Now, why would a woman lower her voice? To be sexy?
I know why.
Precisely.
Yes, because sometimes I've been on the radio with a cold, and people will call up and say, oh, your voice sounds great, when I think it sounds horrible, and it must be that cold syndrome.
Let me tell you, Marjorie, that your voice is actually perfectly settled. Its placement is absolutely correct.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh.
I've never heard anything like that in my life. I've been to so many speech coaches.
Happiest she's been in weeks. But can we get just 10 more seconds on this screaming thing? So you actually teach people to scream in a way that doesn't damage their vocal cords?
But of course. But look, Jim, we opera singers, what do? We basically scream, right? We scream, but we have to do it for hours and without any problems. So we know how to do it. We know how to breathe. We know how to use resonance. And people who scream should employ a few of those techniques as well.
It's fabulous.
And people like Adele that wind up getting their vocal cords operated on.
That's
this
very,
is because
very sad.
Of incorrect.
Yeah.
Incorrect what?
Incorrect singing in her case, and she's a wonderful singer.
She can really scream,
talented.
Don't you think?
Well, yes, but it is actually a technique called belting, believe it
belting,
or not.
Belting, yeah.
And it just means that you're using your chest voice chiefly, but she should be using a few safer tips for that.
Peter Kadzis, before we get to the quiz, we want to start in a second. So is today the final online edition? Is today when it comes out? Or
It was out yesterday. Yeah, the last, I mean, as we always do every day, we add a few more stories. But the very last story, which is written by David Bernstein, the cover
about
story,
Liz Warren.
Is about Elizabeth Warren, Too Big to Fail, about how she is becoming a powerhouse in Washington on financial issues.
And you see the Boston Globe editorial today echoed in part final editorial in the Boston Phoenix about commuting the sentence of Sal DeMasi. Make you feel good?
Some people lead, others follow.
We'll tell Brian McGrory that next Wednesday.
Yeah, please do.
Let's get started. Why don't you ask the first question of your good friend Peter Kadzis, Marjorie
Okay,
Egan.
We're going to play a song and then you're going to guess what it is. Here's the song.
I need to say it. I know that.
Can you name the song, Peter Kadzis?
No, there are two parts of the question, Marjorie.
Well, that's right. Well, don't I ask them part one first?
No, let's give them both.
Okay, can you name the song? Do you know why it's in the news today?
Oh, this is embarrassing, Peter.
It's not. He knows all about politics. I'm sure he'll be fine on that top.
Oh, she set me up for a fall. Ooh, watch her. She looks so
sorry.
Sweet.
Time is up, Elena. It's all yours. What's the song and why is it in the news today?
Well, I knew that it's been 50 years since the Beatles' first album.
Yes.
Which
today,
is...
yes.
Yep, and I think it's Please, Please Me, isn't it? That's the name of the album.
That is the name of the album, and that's good enough. The song is actually There's a Place. Is that right?
Somewhere, yes,
but
yes,
you get
that.
The point. Yep. That was excellent. You're very happy about that, aren't you? Elena, now this.
Now watch her get the political question.
Sorry, Peter.
Are you amazed? You know, one of the things, you remember a couple of years ago, I think it was called 27 or 1 or something. It was the 27 number one hits of the Beatles came out,
great.
What, 40 years or 45 years? And it was the number one bestseller in about 2 minutes, mostly bought by young people, virtually none of whom were, not virtually, all of whom were not alive. None of whom were alive when the Beatles came out. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Well, because they're really good songs. They were
great
songs.
So?
I thought they were very impressive.
That's a fine point. You ready for your deal here? Elena, yes, you are, correct?
I thought you already answered, and I could now have a good time, no?
Okay, this one is actually about Marjorie Egan, my colleague here. Listen to Marjorie Egan reporting from abroad to this radio show not so long ago. Listen up.
I saw him. He was about 30 feet away from me, in the, going by in the mobile, and I was next to all these... This group of Southern Baptists and Methodists from Missouri, and they were all taking pictures of him furiously. So it was really kind of fun.
Okay, so here's the question, Elena. Can you tell me where Marjorie Egan was and what event was she talking about, please?
She probably is in Vatican, and she's probably attending the Pope's.
Yes, she was. Yes, give her the points.
That's right.
Very nicely done.
Thank you. 30 feet away.
I was pretty. I mean,
I feel it was a good luck charm for me.
You were pretty excited about that, were you not, Marjorie?
Well, it was an unbelievable mob scene. I mentioned to you in the radio that the subways were so crowded going to the Vatican, they had to have police downstairs in the subway preventing people from just storming onto these trains. It was really something.
Did you actually see, you know, the thing that a lot of people talked about is evidence of the fact that this Pope really actually cares about poor people, one of the manifestations of it. When did he stop the motorcade and he walked over to a disabled person and
did
he embraced it? Did you see that?
I didn't see it. I saw that in the Jumbotron because they had Jumbotrons if you couldn't see him all the way around, which you couldn't.
Which were live pictures of what, like a rock concert, essentially.
Exactly.
Very Princess Di.
It is very Princess Di.
I mean, that seriously. Yeah.
He's very genuine. And
that's right. He's channeling Princess Di. That's the word in the Vatican.
Next question for Peter Kadz is from Marjorie Egan.
Okay, Peter. Here we go. We're going to play you a little sound here. Okay, here it goes. I think we're playing a little sound here. Are we not?
This is a tape of a tour being given of the Ava Gardner Museum in Smithfield, North Carolina.
Oops.
Is that correct?
Sorry, I goofed that up.
I know you had good luck from your trip to the Vatican, but that's the setup. Here's the sound.
Okay, sorry.
The Ava Gardner Museum has 6,000 square feet of exhibit space related to items from the career and life of Ava Gardner. When you visit the museum, you'll see a large collection of her costumes and awards that she won throughout her career. You're going to also see a large collection of fine art related to Ava and Ava's life.
Okay, Peter, here's your question. That was Sue Bunn. She's a docent at the Ava Gardner Museum in Smithfield, North Carolina. What other gardening museums in the news this week, and why?
Is it that one with the stolen paintings?
Check with the judges. Is that correct?
That would be correct. Absolutely.
Yeah, we were just talking to Emily Rooney, who is more, fair to say, obsessed with it. Now, you're a Boston kid. You've been away here and there, but you've been in Boston most of your life. Are you as obsessed with this story as Emily, not just Emily, there are a ton from the Kirchens to the Mashbergs to
I am. I remember as a little boy going there and being, you know, awestruck by these paintings, you know, that I had seen in postcards. And then when I got there and I saw how magnificent they were. I think it's amazing. And I have a controversial view. I think that the reason that robbery took place is because the terms of her will were not obeyed. There was no one living in the house. I'm apoplectic.
Isabel Stewart Gardner's will. You're talking about.
Who decreed that whoever ran the museum should be living in the house.
Hmm. One of my favorite stories about her was how when she had parties, she would make her guests walk up all the way, all those stairs to greet her and shake her hand because she thought she had been shunned by the highest of Boston society. That is a great story. Yeah, it must be about 35 stairs, right?
Do you know that she was a very devout Anglican? On Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, she would get down on her hands and knees and wash the stairs going up to the Church of the Advent.
No.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, wonderful story.
Elena, are you ready?
Yeah.
I think you are. Here's a clip from a 1980 movie. I love this movie, by the way. Starring Henry Fonda playing a real-life convict.
No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. I asked them for a lawyer. They wouldn't give me one. means I was deprived of my liberty without due process of law.
So here's the question, Elena. Can you name the movie, and can you tell us why we're speaking about it this particular week? Why would that be, Elena, please?
All I remember is that there is some kind of a famous trial that was happening some years ago that changed something, but actually I don't, so...
Well, it did change something. That is correct.
Right.
You'll get a quarter of a point for that.
Oh, thank you.
Peter, well, that's a quarter of a sound, too. So, Peter Kadzis, do you know the answer to that question?
Well, Anthony Lewis wrote the book.
Yes, he did.
And
actually, his wife, who just happens to be
the
former Chief Justice, Margaret Marshall, was in the studio. That's the name of the movie, and why is it in the news this week?
It is the XYZ anniversary.
It is the 50th anniversary, given the points. And by the way, for those who don't recall and didn't hear Margaret Marshall here this week, that's obviously the case that guaranteed people a right to indigence, a right to legal representation in criminal trials. That's who you meant, Elena.
Precisely. Thank you. Thank
Elena,
well, Elena's not American. You know, she wasn't here when the case was probably decided.
Thank you.
Yes.
And the Beatles were international.
Exactly.
Now, Elena, are you? I had read something in the last couple of days when I knew you were coming. Are you? You're in a movie with Brad Pitt. Is that a
true?
You're in a movie with Brad Pitt.
Yes, unless they caught me, which they are deciding right now. But at this point, I am in the movie.
World War Z.
Correct.
Z as in zombies.
Yes, it is.
And what are you? You're not a zombie.
I am not.
What do you
actually
play?
Well, I am an opera singer there, believe it or not, and I am among those survivals.
Mm-hmm.
Survivors,
right? Yeah.
And I am actually singing because apparently zombies are attracted to my voice. And so the plot thing is that I am asked to sing an aria, and it's a bait for zombies. So we lured them into that area for a battle. So that was
so then they're slaughtered or something?
Is yes!
That... Excellent.
Wait a second, is this true? Is this really what it is?
Yes, yes, that is what is
so
happening in the movie.
What's the aria?
Oh, I can't tell you because of the contract I signed with Paramount Pictures. But I can sing you a one phrase from
it. Oh, say, oh, yes, please.
Yes, yes,
wait,
yes.
This is part of the aria that you sing to lure the zombies so they can be slaughtered in battle.
But we have to make sure that there are no zombies among your listeners right now.
We shall see while we're here. Exactly.
So it goes like this.
Go ahead, Elena.
Redeemed Oblakovna. That's the first phrase.
Ooh,
oh, that is beautiful.
Beautiful.
Can you sing one more phrase?
I'll sing you the powerful one. Okay,
I wish you would.
Towards
yes,
the end,
we'd
yeah?
love that.
And so forth.
Oh, my
wow.
goodness. By the way, as you were singing that, every one of our producers was rushing towards the glass. Is that, that is truly, is that, that was stunning, actually. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Elena Zurabeva. That is unbelievable. Okay, so what's the score, judges? Do we know what the score is after one
Come
round?
Come on, give me some more
Anybody
points
keeping
for
score?
Singing, please.
No, they're computing the score.
Do you know,
Peter's leading 4-3, yes. What?
You haven't met Brad Pitt yet, right?
I have.
You
yes.
have met
yeah.
him. What do you think of the Chanel No. 5 ads he's doing? I don't know.
To tell you the truth, that is precisely the makeup that he was wearing when we were filming the movie. And I think maybe that's what coincided with the ad, because he had the same beard, he looked very tight, that's how we were all made up.
Huh.
We actually shared the same makeup artist, so I know the tricks that they were employing. You know.
But he's very handsome, I assume, in person?
Everybody asks me this question. You know what I tell you? Yes, he's handsome, but what really... How do you say strike in past? Stroke me? No.
It struck
really
me. It
struck
me,
me is how wonderful he is with his kids. I think
oh,
he's the
great.
Most wonderful father. Very genuine, and that's something I will never forget.
Okay, Marjorie, next question for Peter Kadzis of the
I'm
Boston
wonderful
Phoenix.
With my kids, too.
Okay.
He is wonderful with his kids. Three wonderful kids, actually. Can we tell a little story about one of your kids being the principal dancer in the Boston
It's a little late not
ballet.
To tell it, isn't it?
Well, he
He was the star of the Nutcracker Suite.
Well, one of the stars.
Yeah, he was the star.
That's pretty exciting, actually. Yeah. Congratulations.
He wants to be. He is studying to be a ballet dancer.
And it is an amazing thing because once Peter Kadzis and I have been friends for years, and once we went to an Arthur Murray,
yes.
dance lessons.
Go?
And well, what happened to you, Peter? You were basically told not to come back. Is that
I flunked out of Arthur Murray dance. Yes. I flunked
yeah.
out.
And here's his son, this unbelievably gorgeous ballet dancer. Anyway,
next question.
Here is somebody doing her Sarah Palin impersonation on Inside the Actors Studio.
I'm a half governor, or you could call me a maverick at large.
Have your views on gun laws or wolves changed at all?
You know, I believe if everybody had guns, then there would be fewer guns in the stores.
Okay. This is not Sarah Palin at CPAC. Can you tell me who it is?
It sounds an awful lot like Tina Fey.
That is correct.
I actually saw her doing this. So
she hasn't done Sarah Palin quite well. Of course, Sarah Palin hasn't done Sarah Palin in a long time either.
Yeah. Sarah Palin's kind of disappeared.
She is.
Thank God.
Well, it's too bad. I used to like these outbursts you'd hear from her every once in a while. You know.
Well, she didn't disappear. She was the star of CPAC.
You know, she had a very good makeup, so I wish she'd remain, because makeup and hair, that was all good.
Yeah, she looks beautiful.
Uh-huh.
She does look beautiful. Okay.
Okay, here's the next question, Elena. This is for you. The question, quite simply, is you're going to listen to sound. You're going to say, answer, who is this, and why does this person not feel at home?
I have to say we actually arranged for that because it made me feel at home. You know, I wouldn't feel comfortable if I didn't have at least one heckler.
Okay, so the question is, who is this and why does he not feel at home?
What a nice guy. I like him a lot. That's your president, ladies and gentlemen, Barack Obama.
Why does he not feel at home when he was heckled there?
He's in Israel.
That is exactly correct. Now, you said, what did you say about Marjorie's voice, that it was perfect or something? What did you say
Settled.
About
her? Settled.
Yep. How about Barack Obama's voice?
Very nice voice. Very nice voice. The only thing I worry about, I don't know if he's still smoking. It definitely affects his... Yeah, well, then...
I think so.
But you know what? His tone, probably the timbre that he was born with, is remarkable. Remarkable. One of the things is why he's so liked, not just because he's a nice guy, which I'm sure he is. I like him a lot. But the voice itself is absolutely beautiful.
What do you mean settled? What does that mean, settled?
It has a very nice placement. Because, see, right now I'm talking normally, but if I will be talking like this, right?
Okay.
Quite different placement, which many people do.
Okay, Peter, speak for 10 seconds, please. Say anything you want.
Oh, say anything. 4 score and 7 years ago. Wow,
stop, it's enough. Is his voice settled?
Yes, it is very good.
Okay, now I'm really nervous. There are two settleds. Hi, I'm Jim Browdy. Elena, I can't wait to see World War Z when it comes out with you luring zombies to the slaughter. Okay, take it away.
Well, if I'll tell you that it was also wonderful, you will not believe me. Because
so tell
then,
me the truth.
Well, it is very good.
It is, really?
Yes.
So are you just being nice to all three of us?
No,
or you're not?
No. And that's, you can call all of my friends. I'm not a nice person, actually.
Really?
No.
I heard that, actually. Thank you.
So if your voice is not settled, what do? Have to go get lessons on how to
settle it? Yes, you have to take lessons. You can go to voice therapy. In fact, the World Voice Day is coming up, which is April 16th, and Boston University Medical will be doing free screening. I highly recommend everybody to go and to take a chance, because it's a great thing when you can really know everything about your voice.
Do you have something coming up, by the way, we were told before? Do you have some event or something you're participating in that you wanted to talk about, or that was it? Okay, fine.
That's it, yes.
Okay, fine. Next question for Peter Kadzis.
Okay.
Yes.
This is, speaking of voices, the voice of local gymnast Ali, I always mispronounce her name, Reisman, I believe it is.
Reisman, I think that's right, yeah.
Reisman.
Here it is.
I'm just really excited, really happy to be in this competition. I want to have fun. I want to show everyone my personality, so hopefully that will help us out.
Okay, Peter Kadzis, she was not talking about the Olympics. What composition is Ali speaking about?
The Cyprus debt crisis?
That's right. Give them the points. Okay. Oh, God. That is pathetic. What, do you know the answer, Elena?
Well, I'm sorry. I saw her during the Olympics. She was wonderful. But now when I hear her voice, that's all I could think of.
Yeah, we're going to get
that. What about her voice?
It's not settled.
Unsettled?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Really?
She has to go to
BU for the test, I guess.
That'd be nice. They have a great doctor, Peter Nutzai.
And if you keep talking in an unsettled voice, we will eventually have problems?
You could get chronic hoarseness.
Ooh.
You could even lose your voice because you could get nodules and all kinds of unpleasant things. It's a very unhealthy thing.
By the way, Dancing with the Stars was the answer to the question.
Sorry.
She's one of the contestants.
Oh.
You don't miss that, I assume, Peter, do you? Or do you?
I must have missed that episode.
That episode. Yeah. Now, Marjorie's not aware of this, but we've run out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We have. So Peter Kadzis, in all seriousness, we're really going to miss the Boston Phoenix.
The Boston
and we're going to miss you in
great
that capacity.
Newspaper, and it's just... It's going to be so missed, and you're going to be missed there, and all the great writers and the great editorials. It's a sad
day. It'll still be online for a while.
Yeah. And we wish you luck, Peter.
Aww.
Elena,
Thank you.
A pleasure to meet you. Elena Zubareva, and you sing beautifully. We can't wait for the movie.
Thank you. Did I lose the game, though?
Oh, what was the final score? Do we know?
I forgot that.
It was 5-5.
A tie.
We'll finish it in the parking lot right after the show.
I love you guys.
Thank you. That's another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. By the way, on Beat the Press tonight at 7 o'clock with Emily Rooney, Marjorie Egan will be one of the panelists. And on Monday, downsizing into tiny spaces, living small. It's a story that Marjorie and I are both totally into. And then the Freegan diet, actually dieting from dumpsters. And the guy who's doing it is bringing something in for us to sample. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Have a great weekend, everybody. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll see you on Monday.